In the control room, one of the technicians at the monitor said, "We're getting field bucks."
"Oh, really? That's good news," Gordon said.
"Why?" Stern said.
"It means," Gordon said, "that someone is headed back in the next 2 hours, undoubtedly your friends."
Gordon broke off, staring at the undulating image on the monitor.
"Is that it?"
"Yes,"
the technician said.
"But the amplitude's much too large."
"Yes, and the interval's getting shorter, fast," said the technician.
"You mean someone is coming back now?"
"Yeah, right away it looks like."
"What does that mean?" Stern asked.
"They must be having some sort of trouble. This soon it's probably mechanical, maybe a transcription error."
Stern said, "What's a transcription error?" The technician said, "I'm calculating an arrival in 2:57.
"How many are coming back?" Gordon said. "All of them?"
"No, just one."
Chris Hughes, Marek, and Kate all stood a little apart from the argument.
All right, goddammit," Beretta was saying.
He took off his weapons and put them on the floor of his cage.
"Screw it, I'm walking," Kate said, and she started down the path. Marek and Chris followed her.
"You people, stay in sight, dammit,"
Beretta called to them. Gomez said, "I think we'd better go." Beretta put a restraining hand on her arm.
"Not until we get something cleared up."
Chris was grateful to move around the curve in the path and leave them behind. Kate started at a brisk walk. After a minute or two, she had left Marek and Chris behind. She heard a sound, like the rumble of distant thunder. She was trying to place that rumble when a teenage boy burst around the corner. The boy was wearing a bright green quilted jacket and a black cap. As he came toward her, he cried, "Aidathi, Amsel! Grâce à Dieu! Aidathi!" An instant later, she heard his voice translated into her earpiece, "Hide, woman, for the sake of God, hide." "Hide from what?" Kate wondered. As the boy passed her, he shoved Erickson hard, pushing her into the woods. She banged her head, felt sharp pain and a wave of dizziness. She was getting to her feet when she realized what the rumbling sound was. Horses, riding at full gallop toward her. Chris saw the young boy running up the path. The boy managed to gasp, "Hide! Hide!" before he darted away into the woods. Chris frowned. "What is all that about?"
"Now,"
Marek said, and throwing an arm around Chris's shoulders, pulled him bodily off the path. Charging up the hill were 6 horsemen in full armor, steel helmets, chain mail, and cloth surcoats of maroon and gray. The lead rider, wearing a helmet with a black plume, pointed ahead and screamed, "Godin!" Beretta and Gomez were still standing beside the path. The black rider leaned over in the saddle and swung his broadsword in an arc at Gomez as he rode past her. Chris saw Gomez's headless torso, spurting blood as it toppled to the ground. Beretta ran into the woods. More riders galloped up the hill. Now they were all shouting, "Godin! Godin!" One rider wheeled on his horse, drawing his bow. The arrow struck Beretta's left shoulder. Cursing, Beretta staggered to his machine. He picked up his belt, yanked one of the grenades free, and turned to throw it. An arrow struck him full in the chest. Beretta sprawled in a seated position against the bars. The next arrow passed through his throat. The grenade dropped from his hands. Back on the path, the horses reared and whinnied, their riders shouting and pointing. There was a bright flash of light. In moments, the machine was gone. The riders raced on up the hill out of sight. As the black rider turned to go, his horse stumbled over Gomez's body. Cursing, the rider wheeled and reared his horse repeatedly, stomping the body again and again. At last, the black rider galloped up the hill to rejoin the others.
"Jesus!"
Chris scrambled to his feet, ran back to the path. Gomez's body lay crushed almost beyond recognition. Next to her lay the white ceramic marker. It was cracked open. Chris picked it up. The ceramic fell apart in his hands. And in that moment, their situation was clear to him. Their return marker was shattered, which meant they were trapped here, without guides or assistance, and with no prospect of ever getting back. Not ever.
"Stand by," the technician said. "Coming in now."
In the center of the curved water shields, flashes of light appeared. Stern saw Beretta sitting there, dead. A small dark object rolled out onto the floor. The explosion flashed in the transit room, blooming white.
"Shit!"
Gordon banged his fist down on the console. The technicians in the transit room were screaming. One man's face was covered with blood. In the next moment, the man was swept off his feet in the rush of water as the shields collapsed, shattered by grenade fragments. Water sloshed back and forth, but almost immediately it began to drain out, leaving the newly bare floor hissing and steaming.
"It's the cells," Gordon said. "They've leaked hydrofluoric acid."
Obscured by smoke, figures in gas masks were running into the room, helping the injured technicians. In the control room, someone gave a gas mask to Gordon and another to Stern. Gordon pulled his on.
"We have to go now. The air is contaminated."
"There are no more machines," Stern said. "Does this mean..."
"Yes. For now, I'm afraid your friends are on their own."
"Just take it easy, Chris," Marek said.
"Take it easy.
We have no marker, which means we have no way to get home, which means we are totally screwed, Andre. And you want me to take it easy? For what? We're all going to get killed here. We're going to get goddamn killed. And there is no way out of here."
"Yes, there is."
"How?"
"The other machine has gone back to New Mexico."
"Yes?
They'll know something is wrong, and they'll send another machine to get us."
Marek turned and started down the hill.
"Where are you going?"
"To find Kate. We have to keep together."
"I'm going to stay right here."
"Just as long as you don't leave."
"Don't worry, I'll be right here.
This is exactly where the machine arrived before, and that's where I'm staying." Marek trotted off, disappearing around the curve in the path. Chris was alone. Almost immediately, he heard a crashing sound. Someone was approaching.
"Tss!"
He turned. It was the teenage boy coming out of the woods. The boy whispered,
"Arkith, thou, Irwashman."
Chris frowned, not understanding, but an instant later he heard a tinny voice inside his ear.
"Hey, you, Irisher." The earpiece was translating, he realized.
"What?" he said.
"Kumin, hastile."
In his ear he heard, "Come quickly." The boy was beckoning to him. "But
come. Sergei will soon realize he has lost the trail. Then he will return to find it again. But you cannot stay here. He will kill you. Come."
"But..." Chris gestured helplessly toward the path where Marek had gone.
"The manservant will find you. Come."
Now he heard the distant rumble of horses' hooves, rapidly growing louder. Chris stood frozen in place, not certain what to do. The boy vanished in dense undergrowth. Chris looked down the path. He didn't see Marek. He had to decide. Now.
"I'm coming,"
he shouted to the boy. Then he turned and ran into the woods. Kate sat on a fallen tree, touching her head gingerly, her wig askew.
"Are you hurt?"
Marek said as he came up to her.
"I don't think so.
Let me see." Lifting the wig away, Marek saw a 3-inch gash across the scalp. The wound deserved sutures, but she would be all right without it. "You'll survive." He pushed the wig back down on her head.
"What happened?"
"Those other two are dead. It's just us now. Chris is a little panicked." She nodded.
"Then we better go get him."
They started up the path.
"What about the markers?"
"The guy went back and took his. Gomez's body was trampled. Her marker was destroyed."
"What about the other one?"
Kate said. "What other one?"
"She had a spare, don't you remember? She said, 'I'm going to burn the spare,' or something like that."
"Well, Chris will be glad to hear it," Marek said. They walked around the final curve. Chris was gone. Plunging through the undergrowth, Chris Hughes heard the horses rearing and snorting and the shouts of the men. He heard one cry, "In the wood!" He kept running. There was a crackling in his left ear. "Chris!" It was Marek.
"Chris, where are you?"
I'm running."
"I hear that. Where are you running?"
"The boy. The village."
"You're going to the village?"
"I think so."
And then behind him, Chris heard a crashing, the shouts of men and the whinny of horses. The riders were coming after him. On the muddy path, Marek looked toward the monastery. It was no more than a 10-minute walk from where they were standing. The professor is probably down there right now. We could just go get him and go home. It would have been so easy. Not anymore, Kate said. Chris saw they were running near the edge of a cliff that overlooked the town and the river. The boy ran hard.
God's truth, we are lost now,
he said, glancing over his shoulder as he raced forward.
Can you swim?
Swim? Chris said. Of course he could swim, but that was not what he was thinking about. Because right now they were running hard, flat out, toward the cliff. Without hesitation, the boy leapt into space. Chris hesitated to follow. Glancing back, he saw the knights charging him, their broadswords raised. No choice. Chris turned and ran forward toward the cliff edge. Marek winced as he heard Chris's scream in his earpiece. They heard nothing more, not even the crackle of static. Nothing at all.
Is he dead?
Kate said. Marek didn't answer her. He walked quickly to Gomez's body. Come on. Help me find that spare marker. They searched for the next few minutes, and then Marek grabbed Gomez's hand and turned her torso over. That was when he noticed that Gomez had a bracelet of braided twine on her wrist. He turned it on her wrist, looking for the latch, and a sort of lid flicked open in the braided twine, and he realized that the bracelet covered a small electronic timer, like a wristwatch. The timer read, 36 hours, 37 minutes, 10 seconds. And it was counting backward. It was an elapsed counter for the machine, showing how much time they had left. They had 37 hours initially, and now they had lost about 20 minutes. He untied the bracelet and wrapped it around his own wrist. He flipped the little lid shut. We've got a timer, Kate said, but no marker. Chris was right. They were trapped there. In the control room, an alarm rang insistently.
We have to go, Gordon said. The air's contaminated from the hydrofluoric acid.
He began to lead Stern out of the control room. But what if they try to come back when everybody is gone?
That can't happen. The wreckage will trigger the infrared. The sensors need 6 feet on all sides, remember? 2 meters. They don't have it, so the sensors won't let the machines come back. Not until we get all that cleared away.
How long will it take to clear it away?
First, we have to exchange the air in the cave.
How long will that take?
In theory, it takes 9 hours.
And after they exchange all the air, what then?
We rebuild the transit pad and wait for them to come back.
And if they try to come back before you're ready for them?
The machine will just refuse.
So they're stranded, Stern said.
For the moment, Gordon said. Yes, they're stranded.
Chris Hughes ran to the edge of the cliff and threw himself into space, screaming. It was too far to fall. He knew the river was too shallow. There was no question he would die. But then he saw there was a protruding shelf of land 20 feet below. He slammed down on the shelf, landing on his side, the impact blasting the air from his lungs. Immediately, he began rolling helplessly toward the edge. Then he felt a tug at his collar and saw the boy standing above him, hauling him back to his feet. The boy looked exasperated. Come now!
Jesus, Chris said.
He flopped onto flat rock, gasping for breath.
Just give me a minute.
An arrow whined past his ear like a bullet. Energized by fear, he scrambled along the shelf. On the cliff above, the horsemen were looking down on them. The boy pulled Chris forward. The shelf ended in a narrow ledge no more than a foot wide. Chris stared at the river, but the boy grabbed his chin, jerked his head up.
Do not look down. Come.
The boy pressed himself flat against the cliff face, hugging the rock and moved gingerly along the ledge. Chris followed his example. Ahead, he saw the cliff ended in a long green slope of forested land that continued all the way down to the river. The boy was waving to him. Chris moved ahead, rejoining the boy.
From here, it is easier.
The boy slipped, slid along the muddy track, vanished into the forest below. With a sigh, Marek got to his feet. There was no marker. Kate stood beside him.
I know, she said, there was a spare. I know it.
Unconsciously, Kate started to scratch her head.
This damn wig.
She stopped. She stared at Marek.
Where did it go?
What?
Her head.
She found it a moment later, surprised at how small it seemed. Fighting revulsion, she crouched down and lifted the wig away and immediately saw the ceramic marker. It was taped to the mesh inside the wig. She pulled it free.
Got it.
We can go back any time we want.
Do you want to go back?
She thought it over. We came here to get the professor, and I think that's what we ought to do.
Marek grinned.
And then they heard thundering hooves, and they dived into the bushes just moments before six dark horsemen galloped down the muddy path, heading toward the river below. Chris staggered forward, knee-deep in boggy marsh at the edge of the river. Chris slid into the river. The water was icy cold. By now the boy had climbed out on the opposite bank and was sitting in the sun on a rocky outcrop. Chris swam to the far side and climbed out.
How bite thou speakest, fool simple Okopan, ik in vichare thou art. Essay thou sooth art reicher in so?
The boy was speaking. An instant later he heard the tinny voice in his ear translating,
The way you speak plainly to your friend and the way you dress, tell the truth. You are Irisher, is it so?
Chris nodded slowly. Apparently the boy had overheard him speaking to Marek on the path and had concluded they were Irish.
I, he said. I, the boy repeated. I?
The word seemed strange to him.
Yes. Yes?
The boy said, speaking it like a hiss.
Yes, Chris said, nodding. Ah, Irisher.
The translation came.
Ah, Irish. Yes. We sayin' yeso. Oriwis, thou say true.
Chris said,
Thou say true.
His earpiece translated his own words.
You speak the truth.
The boy nodded. He looked Chris up and down.
So you are gentle.
Gentle. Of course he was gentle.
Thou say true.
The boy nodded.
I thought as much. Your manner speaks it, even if your attire ill suits your degree. How are you called?
Christopher Hughes.
Ah, Christopher de Hughes. Where is Hughes? In the Irish land?
Thou say true.
Are you a knight?
No.
Then you are a squire. And of what age?
21 year. 24 year. This news caused the boy to blink in surprise.
Then, good squire, I am very glad of your assistance for saving me from Sir Guy and his band.
But I didn't save you. You saved me.
Didn't.
Another puzzled look. Chris sighed, but he tried again.
Yet I did not save you. You saved me. Good squire, you are too humble. I am in your debt for my very life, and it shall be my pleasure to see to your needs once we are to the castle.
Cautiously, Kate and Marek moved out of the woods, heading toward the monastery. Near the monastery wall were clustered the huts of the peasants who worked in the field. Beyond the huts, he saw a small door in the wall. They were moving among the huts when he heard the snort of a horse. Marek pointed. About 20 yards away, hidden from easy view behind one of the huts, 5 horses were held by a groom. The horses were richly appointed, with saddles covered in red velvet trimmed with silver.
What do we do? Kate said.
Chris Hughes was following the boy toward the village when he heard Kate say, What do we do? And Marek answered, I'm not sure.
Chris said, Have you found the professor?
In the earpiece, Marek said, Chris, where the hell are you?
Going to the castle.
Are you still with the boy?
Yes.
The boy turned with a worried look on his face.
Do you speak to the air? Are you with sound mind?
Yes, Chris said. I am with sound mind. I wish only that my companions might join me in the castle.
I am sure they shall join you in good time, the boy said. Tell me of your companions. Are they gentles like you, or servants?
In his ear, Marek said, Why did you tell him you are gentle? Gentle means you are nobility. You'll draw attention to yourself and get embarrassing questions about your family, which you can't answer. Marek turned and looked across the river toward Castelgard. He could see the boy walking slightly ahead of Chris. "Chris, I see you. Turn around and come back. We have to stay together." "Most difficult."
"Why?"
Chris didn't answer him directly. "And who, good sir, may be the horseman on the far bank?" Apparently he was talking to the boy. Merrick shifted his gaze, saw mounted riders at the river's edge, letting their horses drink, watching them go.
"That is Sir Guy de Malagon, called Guy Tête Noire. He is retained in the service of my lord Oliver. Sir Guy is a knight of renown for his many acts of murder and villainy."
Listening, Kate said, "He can't come back because of the knights on horseback."
"You speak true," Chris said.
Merrick shook his head. The creak of a door behind them made Merrick turn. He saw the familiar figure of Professor Edward Johnston coming through the side door of the monastery wall. He was alone.
35 hours, 31 minutes. Edward Johnston was wearing a doublet of dark blue. They rushed up to his side. He was panting. His first words were,
"Do you have a marker?"
"Yes,"
Merrick said. "It's just the two of you?"
"No. Chris also, but he's not here."
Johnston shook his head.
"All right. Quickly, this is how it is.
Oliver's in Castelgarde." He nodded to the town across the river.
"But he wants to move to La Roque before Arnaud arrives. His great fear is that secret passage that goes into La Roque. Oliver wants to know where it is. Everyone around here is mad to discover it because both Oliver and Arnaud want it so badly. It's the key to everything. People here think I'm wise. The abbot asked me to search the old documents, and I found..."
The door behind them opened, and soldiers in maroon and gray surcoats rushed them. The soldiers cuffed Merrick and Kate, knocking them away roughly. But they were careful with the professor, walking on either side of him. The soldiers seemed as if they were a protective escort. Merrick watched in silence as Johnston and the soldiers mounted up and set off on the road.
"What do we do?"
Kate whispered. The professor tapped the side of his head. They heard him say in a sing-song, as if praying,
"Follow me. I'll try to get us all together. You get Chris."
Following the boy, Chris came to the entrance to Castelgarde. Double wooden doors now stood open, guarded by a soldier in a surcoat of burgundy and gray. The guard greeted them with,
"Setting a tent, laying a groundcloth. It is 5 sols to sell in the market on tournament day."
"We are not merchants."
The guard shrugged, and the boy and Chris passed through the doors and entered the village. Immediately inside the walls were several farmhouses. They made their way to a winding cobblestone street. Now they were in the town itself. The street was narrow and busy, and the buildings 2 stories high, with the 2nd story overhanging. The buildings were all open shops. The boy led Chris to the drawbridge leading into the castle. Chris heard his feet thump hollowly on the wood. There were 2 guards at the gate, but the guards paid no attention at all. Chris was surprised. "They do not guard the entry? Why should they? It is daytime, and we are not under attack."
As he walked through the entrance, he glanced up at the spikes of the portcullis, the large iron grate now raised above his head. That grate could be lowered in a moment, and if it was, there would be no entry into the castle, and no escape. He had entered the castle easily enough, but he was not sure it would be as easy to leave. They entered a large courtyard. Directly ahead, he saw a castle within the castle. The boy led him toward it. To one side, a door stood open. A single guard munched a piece of chicken. The boy said,
"We are to the Lady Claire. She wishes this Irisher to do her service."
"So be it,"
the guard grunted. They went inside. The boy led Chris up a winding narrow stair to the 2nd floor, then down a stone corridor into a suite of rooms. 3 maids rushed to the boy and embraced him.
"By the grace of God, my lady, you are returned."
Chris said,
"My lady?"
Even as he said it, the black hat was thrown away, and golden hair tumbled down over her shoulders. She gave a little bow that turned into a curtsy.
"I am heartfelt sorry and beg your forgiveness for this deception."
"Who are you?" Chris said, stunned.
"I am called Claire."
He saw that she was older than he had thought, perhaps 22, and very beautiful. One of the maids curtsied and said, "If it please you, she is the Lady Clare of Eltham, newly widowed of Sir Geoffrey of Eltham, who holds great estates in Guienne and Middlesex. Sir Geoffrey died of his wounds from Poitiers, and now Sir Oliver, ruler of this castle, serves as my lady's guardian. Sir Oliver feels she must be married again, and has chosen Sir Guy de Malagon. But this match my lady refuses. My lady says to all the world that Sir Guy lacks the means to defend her estates in France and England. Yet Sir Oliver will have his fee from this match, and Guy has..." "Elaine, enough talk," Claire said. "Here is my savior of this day, Squire Christopher of Hughes. He has delivered me from the predations of Sir Guy, who sought to take by force what he could not win freely at court." Chris said, "No, no, that is not what happened at all." He broke off as he realized that everyone was staring at him. "Sooth, he speaks queerly," Claire said, "for he comes from some remote part in the lands of Ire, and he is modest as befits a gentle. He did save me, so I shall introduce him to my guardian once Christopher has proper attire." She turned to one of the ladies. "Is not our horsemaster, Squire Brandon, of his same length? Go to, and fetch me his indigo doublet, his silver belt, and his best white hose." She handed the girl a purse. "Pay what he asks." The girl scurried off. As she left, she passed a gloomy, elderly man standing in the shadows. He wore a rich robe of maroon velvet, with an ermine collar. "How now, my lady?" he said, coming forward. She curtsied to him. "Well, Sir Daniel."
"You are safely returned."
"I give thanks to God."
The gloomy man snorted. "As well you should. And did your trip yield success equal to its dangers?"
"I fear not."
"Did you see the abbot?"
"No, he was abroad on a hunt."
"Why did you not await him?"
"Lord Oliver's men broke sanctuary to take the magister away. I feared discovery, and so fled."
"Yes, yes, this troublesome magister. He is on every tongue. Do you know what they say? That he can make himself appear in a flash of light."
Sir Daniel shook his head.
"He must be a skilled magister of the gunpowder. Did you set eyes upon this magister?"
"Indeed, I spoke to him, for they say the magister has befriended the abbot." Chris Hughes said, "Magister?" Claire said, "Do you know the magister? Edward de Johns?"
No. No, I don't, and..."
At this, Sir Daniel stared at Chris in open astonishment. He turned to Claire.
"What does he say?"
"He says he does not know the magister."
"In what tongue?"
"A kind of English, Sir Daniel, with some Gaelic."
"No Gaelic as I have ever heard."
He turned to Chris.
"Speak you la langue?"
"No."
"La Ciris ne Latine?"
He was asking if he spoke Latin. Chris had a reading knowledge. He'd never tried to speak it. Faltering, he said,
"Non, Signor Danielis, solum per palulum perdoleo."
"Only a little. Sorry."
"He speaks like Cicero."
"Perdoleo. Sorry."
"Then you may profitably be silent."
The old man turned back to Claire.
"Did the magister know the secret we seek?"
"He said he did not."
"But he must know.
It was his predecessor, the Bishop of Laon, who served as architect for the last repairs of La Roque." Claire said,
"The magister said that Laon was not the architect."
"No?"
Sir Daniel frowned.
"And how does the magister know that?"
"Perhaps he saw it among the old papers. The magister has undertaken to sort the parchments of Saint-Mer for the benefit of the monks."
"Does he? Well, the magister will be here soon enough, and Lord Oliver himself will ask these questions."
He frowned, clearly unhappy at this thought. The old man turned abruptly to a young boy of 9 or 10 standing behind him.
"Take Squire Christopher to my chamber, where he may bathe and clean himself."
33 hours, 55 minutes. The horses clattered across the drawbridge. The professor stared straight ahead, ignoring the soldiers that escorted him. Standing near the drawbridge, Kate said, "What do we do now? Do we follow him?" Merrick didn't answer her. Looking back, she saw that he was staring at two knights on horseback fighting with broadswords on the field outside the castle. It appeared to be some kind of demonstration, and a large crowd of spectators had gathered, laughing and shouting. The swords clanged again and again in the morning air. For the first time, Merrick felt a twinge of uncertainty. Until now, nothing he had seen in this world had seemed unexpected. It was all as he had imagined it. But not this, he thought, watching the knights fight. It was so fast. The swordplay was so swift that it looked more like fencing than sword fighting. Merrick had always imagined these fights as taking place in slow motion, ungainly, armored men wielding swords so heavy that each swing was an effort. Merrick heard Kate say, "Andre." He turned slowly toward her. "Andre, is everything all right?"
"Everything is fine, but I have a lot to learn."
They walked down the castle drawbridge, approaching the guards. They passed through the stone arch and entered the castle courtyard.
"We just walked in," Kate said, surprised.
She looked around the courtyard.
"Now what?"
Chris sat shivering on this wooden stool while the boy scrubbed him. Chris was perplexed. He'd always thought that medieval people were dirty and smelly, yet everyone he saw in the castle was clean and there were no odors. Sir Daniel entered. He brought neatly folded clothes, rich and expensive. He placed them on the bed.
"So, Christopher of Hughes, you have involved yourself with our clever beauty."
"She hath saved mine life." He pronounced it Saved, and Sir Daniel seemed to understand.
"I hope it will not cause you trouble."
"Trouble?" Sir Daniel sighed.
"She tells me, friend Chris, that you are gentle, yet not a knight. You are a squire."
"In sooth, yes."
"A very old squire. What is your training at arms? Have you any at all? Speak plain."
"In sooth, I am... a scholar."
"A scholar? You study under a master?"
"Ita est, even so."
"Ubi?"
"Where?" Oxford.
"Oxford?" Sir Daniel snorted. "Then you have no business here. Believe me when I say this is no place for a scholare. Let me tell you how your circumstances now lie. Lord Oliver needs money to pay his soldiers, and he has plundered all he can from the nearby towns. So now he presses Claire to marry, that he may gain his fee. Guy de Maligant has tendered a handsome offer, but Guy cannot make good on his fee unless he mortgages part of my lady's holdings. To this she will not accede. Many believe that Lord Oliver and Guy have long since made a private agreement, one to sell the Lady Claire, the other to sell her lands. There is a further impediment to the match. Claire despises Maligant, whom she suspects had a hand in her husband's death. Guy was in attendance of Geoffrey at the time of his death. Everyone was surprised by the suddenness of his departure from this world. Geoffrey was a young and vigorous knight. Although his wounds were serious, he made steady recovery. There are rumors of poison. My lady might as well be a prisoner of Lord Oliver. She may herself slip out, but she cannot secretly remove her entire retinue. If she secretly returns to England, which is her wish, Lord Oliver will take his revenge against me and others of her household. She knows this, and so she must stay. Lord Oliver wishes her to marry, and my lady devises stratagems to postpone it, but Lord Oliver will force the matter soon. Now, her only hope lies there."
Sir Daniel walked over and pointed out the window. Chris came to the window and looked. He saw a view over the courtyard and the battlements. Beyond, he saw the roofs of the town and the fields and countryside.
"There, my scolare, the fires."
He was pointing in the far distance.
"That is the company of Arnaud de Servolles. They will reach here in a day, 2 days at most. All know it.
And Sir Oliver?
He knows his battle with Arnaud will be fierce.
And yet he holds a tournament.
That is a matter of his honor. Certes, he would disband it if he could, and herein lies your hazard.
My hazard?
Sir Daniel sighed.
Dress you now to meet my Lord Oliver. I shall try to avert the coming disaster.
32 hours, 40 minutes. It was a peculiarity of medieval scholarship that there was not a single contemporary picture that showed what the interior of a 14th-century castle looked like. This was why artists' reconstructions of the 14th century tended to show bleak interiors with bare walls and few furnishings. This flashed through Kate Erickson's mind as she entered the great hall of Castelgarde, what she was about to see no historian had ever seen, and she stared. The great hall sparkled like an enormous jewel. Sunlight streamed through high windows onto walls that gleamed with tapestries laced with gold, so that reflections danced on the red and gold-painted ceiling. At the end of the room stood a huge ornate fireplace, large enough for a person to walk into without ducking. In front of the fire was laid the high table, draped in white linen with dishes of gold, all heaped high with food. Little dogs scampered across the table, helping themselves to the food, until the man in the center of the table swatted them away. Lord Oliver Devon was about 30, with small eyes set in a fleshy, dissolute face. His mouth was permanently turned down in a sneer. His clothes were ornate as the room, a robe of blue and gold with a high-necked gold collar and a fur hat. His necklace consisted of blue stones, each the size of a robin's egg. He wore rings on several fingers. He stabbed with his knife at food and ate noisily, grunting to his companions. But despite the elegant accoutrements, the impression he conveyed was of a dangerous petulance. Kate stared, and a word came unbidden to her mind. Warlord. This was a medieval warlord, sitting with his soldiers in the castle he had captured. A wooden staff banged on the floor, and a herald cried,
"My lord, Magister Edward de Johns."
Turning, she saw Johnston shoved through the crowd. Lord Oliver looked up.
"I bid you welcome, Magister Edwardus."
"Lord Oliver," the professor said, speaking in Occitan.
"Magister, why so cool? Are you displeased I brought you from the monastery?"
Johnston did not speak.
"You have nothing to say?"
Oliver said, glaring at Johnston.
"That will change."
Lord Oliver seemed to collect himself. He smiled.
"But come, come, let us not quarrel.
I seek your counsel, and I am told you can see the future."
"No man sees that."
"Oh, so?"
"I think you do, Magister. And I pray you, see your own. I would not see a man of your distinction suffer much. So, think on it. You are my counselor, or you are not long for this world."
Lord Oliver was interrupted by a knight who slipped down the table and whispered in his ear. This knight was richly dressed in maroon and gray. A deep scar, almost a welt, ran down his face from forehead to chin and disappeared into his high collar. Oliver listened and then said,
"Oh, you think so, Robert? Well, we shall see."
Standing in the crowd, Marek turned to the courtier beside him and, speaking in Occitan, said,
"Pray, what worthy now has the Lord's ear?"
"Faith, friend, that is Sir Robert de Keir."
"De Keir? I do not know of him. He is not yet in service a year, but he has found much favor in Sir Oliver's eyes."
"Oh, so? Why is that?"
"Sir Robert has a martial disposition, and has been a trusted adviser to Lord Oliver on matters of warfare. But, certes, I think he cannot be pleased to see another adviser in one so eminent before him now."
Oliver said,
"Magister."
"My lord."
"I am informed that you know the method of Greek fire."
Marek snorted. He whispered to Kate,
"No one knows that."
And no one did. Greek fire was a famous historical conundrum, a devastating incendiary weapon from the 6th century A.D., the precise nature of which was debated by historians.
"Yes, Johnston said. I know this method. Marek stared. Clearly the professor had recognized a rival, but this was a dangerous game to be playing. He would undoubtedly be asked to prove it. You can yourself make Greek fire?
My lord, I can.
Ah? Oliver turned and shot a glance back at Sir Robert. It seemed the trusted adviser had given wrong advice. Oliver turned back to the professor.
It will not be difficult, the professor said, if I have my assistance.
So that was it. The professor was making promises in an attempt to get them all together.
Eh? You have assistance? Well, of course they can assist you, Magister. And you also know the one secret that I wish to know above all others?
Sir Oliver, that secret I do not know.
You do, and you will answer me. I will have your answer this day.
He puffed in fury. Then he nodded to the guards, take him away and give him cause to meditate.
Guards grabbed the professor and hauled him back through the silent crowds. Kate and Marek stepped aside as he passed, but the professor did not see them. Lord Oliver glared at the silent room.
Be seated and be merry before I am in temper.
Immediately the musicians began to play, and the noise of the crowd filled the hall. Soon after, the herald's staff banged on the floor.
My lord, the Lady Claire de Eltham and Squire Christopher de Hughes.
Hell, Marek said. A beautiful young woman came into the hall, with Chris Hughes now wearing expensive, courtly clothes. Marek tapped his ear and whispered,
Chris, as long as you're in this room, don't speak and don't act. Do you understand?
Chris nodded.
Behave as if you don't understand anything. It shouldn't be difficult.
Lord Oliver watched the woman approach with open annoyance. The woman saw it, dipped low, and she stayed there close to the ground, head bowed in submission.
Come, come, Lord Oliver said irritably. This obsecration ill suits you.
My lord?
She rose to her feet. Oliver snorted.
And what have you dragged in with you today? Another dazzled conquest?
If it please, my lord, I present you Christopher of Hughes, a squire of Era, who saved me from villains who would have kidnapped me today, or worse.
Eh? Villains? Kidnapped?
Amused, Lord Oliver looked down the table at his knights.
Sir Guy, what say you?
A dark-complected man stood angrily. Sir Guy Maligant was dressed entirely in black, black chainmail and a black surcoat.
My lord, I fear my lady amuses herself at our expense. She knows full well I set my men to save her.
Sir Guy walked toward Chris, glaring at him.
It is this man who placed her at risk of her life. I cannot think she now defends him.
Maligant walked up to Chris until they were standing inches apart. He deliberately began to take off his chainmail glove.
Squire Christopher, is it how you are called?
Chris nodded. He was terrified. Through his earpiece, he heard Marek say,
Don't speak, no matter what.
Sir Guy squinted at him.
I asked of you a question, squire. Will you answer?
Sir Guy turned to the woman.
Madam? Does he speak your savior, squire?
If it please, Sir Guy, he is of foreign parts and often does not comprehend our tongue.
Maligant looked disgusted.
Most convenient, for we cannot ask how he comes here and for what purpose. See how he trembles.
What can he fear?
Nothing from us, my lord, unless he be the creature of Arnaud, come to see how the land lays. This would make him dumb. A coward would not dare speak.
Marek whispered, Do not respond.
Maligant poked Chris hard on the chest.
So cowardly, squire. I call you spy and scoundrel, and not man enough to admit your true cause.
The knight finished removing his glove and dropped it on the floor. The chainmail glove landed with a clunk on Chris's toes. Sir Guy turned insolently away and started back to the table.
Everyone in the room was staring at Chris. Beside him, Claire whispered, The glove.
He glanced at her sideways.
The glove. What about the glove, he wondered, as he bent over and picked it up. He held the glove out to Claire, but she had already turned away, saying, Knight, the squire has accepted your challenge. Chris thought, what challenge? Sir Guy said immediately,
Three lances untipped, à outrance.
Marek said, You poor bastard, do you know what you just did? Sir Guy turned to Lord Oliver at the high table.
My lord, I pray you let the day's tourney begin with our challenge combat.
So it shall be,